The concept here is halach from text to practice, and it was inspired by an experience I had about 4 years ago, and it was an experience that took a whole year. It was at the time that I learned, by the way, I wanted to do the halach of Shemitah. That was my original plan, but I started it, and I thought this would come out better, so we switched. About 4 years ago, I was in my last year of smicha. And during that year, I studied the halachos of milk and meat and other halachos of kashas, and I realized that even though I'd been studying in yeshiva full-time for 10 years, I did not know the sources of the halachos of kashas. 10 years full-time. And I couldn't tell you which psukim were relevant, I couldn't tell you where the halachos were in the Rambam. So I thought maybe we could look at the sources from the text of the halacha and then apply them as necessary. So, but since it's a practice of halacha, please just ask any questions that come up, like, you know, I mixed something with a spoon, what am I going to do with that? Anything that comes to mind by association, as long as it has to do with something Jewish, please feel free to share it with us, okay? Is that clear? That's the experience was that year of exploring sources that I had never seen before. So why are we doing this? Well, we're going to start with halachas of Shavuos. That's our first source. And then we'll get into the halachos of kashrus. So the first source is taken from the Ramah. The Ramah, a really wonderful person. He was the rabbi in Krakow in the mid-1500s. I actually saw his chair. If you go to the shul in Krakow, you can see the chair that he sat in. He was an unbelievable person. For one reason, he died at the age of 34. And by the time he died at the age of 34, he had written two of the most important halachic works of the last 500 years, 600 years, 700 years, maybe since the Rambam. So that the Ramah wrote his commentary on the Torah, but more importantly for us, he wrote a commentary, he wrote additions to the Shulchan Aruch, and that's what we're quoting from over here. The Ramah says in the halachos of Shavuos...
Sorry, is this considered the Beit Midrash?
Yes. Yes. And if they can't get in, tell them to just knock. We'll open the door.
Okay.
But yeah, you see, those are the kind of questions that we're looking for.
I'm sorry.
That's what I'm talking about.
Actually, can I just give a quote? I'll tell her the quote. She could just put it in.
It's 6, 13, 18 pound might work.
Okay. 6, 13, 18.
It might work. If it doesn't, just let us know. I'll just put that on the internet. Okay. So the Ramah says like this. Noagim b'chol makom. He says the minhag in every place. Usually the Ramah says noagim b'medino seinu. He says the minhag in Germany, in Poland. But here he says the minhag all over. Wherever Jews are, there's a minhag lechol machol echolav b'yom rishon shel shavuos, to eat milk dishes on the first day of Shavuos. So the first thing that's interesting over here is who has milk on the second day of Shavuos? When I was growing up, and therefore probably still, we had milk on the second day of Shavuos. But the minhag over here that the Ramah quotes is to eat milk dishes on the first day of Shavuos. Hello. We already gave the instruction that everybody's welcome to ask as many questions as they want. Venerely. So why is it? This is some of the words got squashed together when I copied and pasted it. So venerely, no mama. Why is it that we eat milk on Shavuos? What's the reason that we eat milk on Shavuos? Rabbi Rothstein is giving a shiur on Megillas Rus over there. Also, if you prefer to stay here, you're welcome to stay here. We are doing the halachos of milk and meat on Shavuos. I passed you one. There you go. So why is it? What are the reasons that we've heard? Why do we eat milk on Shavuos?
Because the laws weren't given yet. This is kashrus.
So the famous one, which is quoted by the Mishnah Berurah, is that when Jews got the Torah on Shavuos, so one of the laws of the Torah was that they can't eat milk and meat together. They have to slaughter their animals. They have all these halachos of kashrus that we know now, but for them they're completely unfamiliar. So they all became vegetarians on Shavuos because they didn't have the ability to slaughter meat, so they had to pull back. That's why we eat milk. But the Ramah gives a different reason. It's like the two cooked things that we leave on the Seder plate. What are the two cooked things? So in my house we use a shank bone and an egg. Right? Different people use different things, but there are two cooked foods on the Seder plate. Why do we keep two cooked foods? It's because there are two special karbanos that are brought on Pesach. One is the Karban Pesach, and one is the Karban Chagiga. So he says that's why we have milk on Shavuos. What does he mean? Kain ochlin macholi cholav v'akach machol basar. So he says we have milk for our first meal. Now, no good Jew is just going to have a milk meal on Yontif. Of course, you're going to have meat afterwards. That was the minhag of the time of the Ramla. Most people, I think, when they have milk, they just have milk. But there are many people who are careful to have. What's that?
Chabad does that.
Chabad. A lot of Hasidim are careful to do this. They have a milk meal and then a meat meal afterwards. So, where did you see that in Hasidim in Boston? Do they do that?
I heard of it.
So that's what the Ramah says. The Ramah says to have a milk meal and then afterwards have a meat meal. It says, now, if you're having bread at your milk meal, okay, and then you're having a meat meal, are you going to have the same loaf of bread for both? So he says, no, of course not, because if you had it during your milk meal, you probably got some chocolate, some cheesecake crumbs on the bread. So of course you can't serve the same loaf of bread at the next meal. So what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to get another loaf of bread, okay? So you have one loaf of bread for your first meal and one loaf of bread for your second meal. Why is that important? Why are two loaves of bread important?
Did they have to bench?
They did have to bench in between, yes. They did have to bench in between because you can't have milk and meat at the same meal. So why is it important that they had two loaves of bread? For Lech Mishnah, that they always have two loaves of bread. Why is it important on Shavuos? They had one loaf of bread at the first meal, one loaf of bread at the second meal, because on Shavuos there was a carbon brought in the Beis HaMikdash, called the Shtei HaLechem. The Shtei HaLechem was Shtei HaLechem. It was two loaves of bread, and it was brought on the Mizbeach. So that's why we want to have two loaves of bread on Shavuos, one for the milk meal and one for the fleishig meal. If you had just a fleishig meal, so then you could just have one loaf of bread. You're right, you have to have two for Lech HaMishnah. But this is a way of forcing us to eat two loaves of bread. So, but that was brought on the Mizbeach. This is just a Shabbos meal. So listen to the Ramah says. So therefore, we have to bring shtei beis lechem ala shulchan shehu b'makom ha-mizbeach. You ever heard that a table's like a Mizbeach? You ever heard that growing up? That was what I was told when I was a kid. So this is one of the sources. He says that when you're eating your suda on Yontif, it's not just a meal. It's a meal on Shavuos. And a meal on Shavuos is like bringing a carbon in the Beis HaMikdash. What carbon is it? Specifically, we're bringing the two loaves of bread, the Shtei HaLechem. And just to point out, the two loaves of bread are symbolic of the luchos, which we got on Shavuos. That's why they're big and they're long. They look like the luchos. So over here, what we see is that the Ramah is saying that the minhag of having milk on Shavuos is based not so much on the milk, but on the concept that you can't mix milk and meat. And that's what inspired me to talk about eating milk and meat on Shavuos. Okay, so that's the that's our excuse to learn about milk and meat at this time. Any questions? Great, straightforward. So let's start. I wanted to go through some of the sources of milk and meat and thereby get to some of the halachos that we're very familiar with. Yeah?
Is this the only time that there's bread on the Mizbeach? Because oftentimes you're not supposed to have chametz on the Mizbeach.
So you're right. Most karbanos that are brought, when they are made of bread, they're made of matzah. For example, the todah, which was brought whenever somebody had something to be grateful for. Let's say they were sick and they were healed, or they crossed the ocean in a boat. So then they had to bring a carbon todah, and the carbon todah had with it 40 loaves of bread. Of those 40 loaves of bread, 30 were matzah, and 10 were chametz. There were some karbanos that had chametz, but usually you're right, the karbanos were matzah. The pasuk in the beginning of Parshas Vayikra says that you're not allowed to bring any chametz on the Mizbeach. So, but those means in the standard cases, in the cases where the Torah explicitly tells us to bring chametz, that's a mutter. But I'm not sure actually in this case if the Shtei HaLechem were chametz or matzah. I'm not sure. Whenever we call bread chametz and matzah, but the Torah calls the whole thing lechem. So even in this case, I'm not sure if it was matzah or chametz. Okay, so let's get to the Chumash. What's the only place, the only pasuk that talks about milk and meat in the Torah. So the same pasuk appears three times, but it is the only reference to milk and meat in the Torah. There's a Mishnah in Chagiga that's talking about something completely different. The Mishnah says that there are some halachos that there are these huge, robust volumes of halacha, and it says they're tolim b'seyar, but they hang by a hair, by a thread. And the Mishnah is talking about like the halachos of nidarim, when you're allowed, if somebody accepts to do a mitzvah, when they're allowed to change their mitzvah. For example, actually, somebody came to me right before Pesach, and there was somebody who, in Ashkenazi, who, for whatever reason, wanted to start eating kitnios on Pesach. For a number of compounding reasons, they wanted to start eating kitnios on Pesach. So if the minhag that they kept already was to not eat kitnios, to change minhagim, they would have to be matana, they have to change the... A minhag is when done multiple times, becomes a habit, and the habit becomes a neder, becomes like a promise that you'll keep the mitzvah. So you have to undo it with hataras and darim. So that's what the Mishnah is talking about in Chagiga. It's a whole gigantic area of halacha that has minuscule mention in the Torah. This is another case. All the Torah says, Reishis b'kur ad mascha tavi beis Hashem. That just means that you have to bring bikurim, the first fruits of the beis hamikdash. And then the end of the pasuk says, Lo sevashel gediva chalivimel. Don't cook a child goat in the milk of its mother. That's the only reference to bas v'chala, meaning, is it like the mitzvah that we encounter the most often in our daily lives? What do we encounter more than halachos of kashrus? And the most prominent part of halachos of kashrus is milk and meat. The whole thing is five words, the same five words that appear three times. So in Tanakh, we're not going to find so much to go. So what was the text that I thought to use? I wanted to use the Rambam, because the Mishnayos about Bas Rechalav are exceptionally complicated to work through. And the Shulchan Aruch is also very complicated. When I say that they're complicated, what I mean is that they're not divided by concept. You have like these concepts that flow into each other. For example, the Shulchan Aruch has two sections about the laws of mixing milk and meat. One is called basr chalav, milk and meat. The other is called tarovet, mixing. There's mixing milk and meat. He has those two different sections. And each one is about, I don't know, 75 pages long. So they overlap in lots of places, and then you'll have some halachos that you expect to be in one place, and they'll really be in someplace else. So it's hard to follow the halachos of basr chalav and all other types of mixtures in the Shulchan Aruch, but the Rambam has a simpler way. So what I want to look at in the Rambam as we develop the fundamentals in the text of Bas Rechalav, of the laws of kosher for milk and meat, but also you'll see that they overlap with other areas. A is which parts are d'oraisa, meaning which parts are associated with this pasuk specifically. It only has five words, but which parts are associated with that, and which parts come from other areas but are applied over here. We'll see that also. And which parts are not at all d'oraisa, so they don't come from the Torah, but were added by the Rabbanan over the centuries. There are practical nafkaminas. Actually, this was a question I got on my interview for Kol Elyon. So I'm so glad you asked. I had an interview with Rabbi Bleich. I think this was only my second conversation with Rabbi Bleich. My first conversation was about 30 seconds, and then my second conversation was when I interviewed with him. And Rabbi Bleich asked me, let's first read the first halacha, and then we'll get to the application. So this is the Rambam has 14 books in his Mishneh Torah. We don't actually call it Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah means the repetition, or means the repetition of the Torah. That's what the Rambam called his halachic work. And Jewish people found his name offensive, the name that he called his work. He called it Mishneh Torah, and he writes in his introduction, the reason I called it Mishneh Torah is because they're really, you know, you have to know two things in life. You have to know Tanakh, so you go to Ray Rothstein, and you also have to know what I write in my book. So you just read those two books, you read the Tanakh, and you read my book, Mishneh Torah, and you're good to go. So people found that a little offensive. So they changed the name, and they don't call it Mishneh Torah. It's right, actually right over here. See that? So this is the Rambam. What's the Rambam called it? Mishneh Torah. And then on the bottom it says, Hu Hayad HaChazaka. It means the strong hand. The Rambam didn't call it Yad HaChazaka. That's the name that the Jewish people gave it as a way of, you know, circumventing the name that he gave it. So that's the Yad HaChazaka. Why is it called Yad HaChazaka? Because there are 14 volumes. Yod Dalet, there are 14 volumes of the Rambam's work. I think there are actually... you look at the number 14 appears in many places in the Rambam's writing, and it's been suggested the reason is the Rambam's brother was named David, and David has the gematria of 14. Now David was the Rambam's patron; he supported him as he studied, and his brother David died tragically in a ship accident. This might be legend; I don't know if it's even true, but. That's what they say. So, and only after his brother died did the Rambam go on to be a famous doctor because he needed to make money. But before that, he was supported by his brother, and he spent his time studying. So there are those who have suggested that the number 14 appears in the Rambam's works as a testament to his brother David. Okay. Oh, so one of his books. Let's go back to where we're talking about. One of his books is called Kedusha. That's actually this one right over here. It's the fourth volume of his 14 volumes. And in Kedusha, he talks about things that have to do with the holiness of the Jews. So what would you put in the holiness of the Jews? So the Rambam put in Kashrus. So it's actually this week's, it's Parshas Kedoshim. I don't know what I would put in, but the Rambam puts in two things. He puts in the laws of Kashrus, and he puts in the laws of relationships between men and women, because these are two areas that people need, that people are supposed to work within, but also keep boundaries. And boundaries are the foundation of holiness. So he has in Kedusha, and in Kedusha, the first section of Kedusha is Machalos Asuros. That's what we're talking about over here. So in the ninth parak, one of the wonderful things about the Rambam is that he breaks it into chapters, as opposed to like the Shulchan Aruch that breaks things into simanim. So he'll have like, you know, 180 simanim about the laws of Kashrus and everything else. He'll put it all together. The Rambam has it in chapters, so there are only about 20 chapters in, I think there are 24 chapters in Kedusha. So chapter 9, parak tes, is about Bas B'chol. So you look all the way at the beginning, and he starts exactly how you would want him to start. He starts with the Pesukim. Basar b'chalav, this is the third source. Basar b'chalav, asu levashlo, you're not allowed to cook milk and meat. Okay, so that we already know, that's the pasuk. The pasuk says, lo sevashel gedi b'chalav imo, don't cook a goat in its mother's milk. Va'asu le'achlo min haTorah, and you're not allowed to eat it. We don't know, and he says that's in the Torah, but we actually don't know the source for that. Va'asar b'hana, and you're not allowed to benefit from it. If you, for example, let's say you own a store that sells cheeseburgers. You're not allowed to own a store that sells cheeseburgers. Why? Because you're selling things that are asar b'hana, you're not allowed to benefit from it. So you have a cheeseburger, it's asar b'hana. You're not allowed to benefit. So there are three isurim. There are three things that are us. You're not allowed to eat it, you're not allowed to cook it, and you're not allowed to, we'll say, sell it. But it means you're not allowed to benefit from it. Shenemar, we just skipped a couple of words. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, our Pasuk, Lo Sevashel Gedi V'Chaliv Imo. So you're not allowed to cook it. But the Rambam's left with a question. It doesn't say you're not allowed to eat it. V'chein ha'ochel kezayis mishneim, if you eat a kezayis, an olive's worth of the two of them together, minabasar v'alchov v'nuspashul ke'achad, if the milk and meat are cooked together, loka, so then the person is punished with lashes, which is the standard punishment for most averos in the Torah. Alpha pishalu bishal. So if you cook it or you eat it, that's included in the prohibition. V'lo shasa kakasuv milasor ha'achila ela mepnei she'asar abishal. So why doesn't it say you're not allowed to eat it? So the Ram says, you don't have to tell me you're not allowed to eat it if I tell you you're not allowed to cook it. So obviously you're not allowed to eat it. If you were allowed to eat it, so you'd be allowed to cook it. So the first step is cooking it. The second step is eating it. If I say the first step is not allowed, so obviously the second step is not allowed. Kilomar, as if the pasuk is telling you, obviously, vafilu, even bishlo aser, even if you eat it, even if you cook it, it's aser vein tzarch lomar achil aso. And for sure, you're not allowed to eat it. So what's interesting over here is that the Rambam, just to point out, the Rambam is actually not taking the standard approach to the source for not eating basra challah. Because you may have, if you look, Rashi and Chumash quotes a different source on this pasuk. It says, Los vasho gediba chalivimo. So what does Rashi say? Rashi
three times.
It says it exactly. It says it three times. What are the three things? One is for cooking, one is for eating, and one is for hana, one is for selling it. So Rashi says it's just that it says it three times. The Rambam is kind of working with that. He's manipulating it to explain it in this way. The Rambam's not arguing with Rashi, because Rashi is just quoting the Gemara, and the Rambam is quoting that same Gemara, but the Rambam is extracting overlaying his own interpretation on the Gemara. So it's not enough just to say three times, because okay, three times. Now, what are the three things you're going to include? How do you choose? What do you do? So he says, this is what I think the three things are. He's explained the second one. The third one is probably one of the halachos that I skipped. So we'll start with that. Rashi says in Chumash there are three times that it says it, so that's why we have three prohibitions: cooking, eating, selling. The Rambam says that it says you can't cook it, so that it assumes that you can't eat it. And whenever you can't eat something, you're also not allowed to sell it unless there's an explicit pasuk that allows it. So this is a little deceptive, because most things that you can't eat, you are allowed to sell. For example, cat food. It's not kosher, but you're allowed to sell it. You're allowed to have a cat food store. And all things like that. It's really only this and like two or three other things. But all those, the Gemara Masechta goes through each of those things, and it lists a pasuk that says, well, this you're allowed to sell, and this you're allowed to sell, and that you're allowed to sell. According to the Torah, you're allowed to sell it. Midrabanan, you're not allowed to.
It's the milk and meat combined.
But milk and meat, you're not allowed to sell midraisa. I was once at Rabbi Herschel Schechter's house for Friday night dinner, and he said that somebody called him that morning, and he said he had bought, a couple of weeks earlier, he had bought a sausage processing plant. And it was a non-kosher sausage processing plant that he was going to convert to a kosher sausage. Great, who doesn't like kosher sausage? But then what happened was he figured the conversion process would take about a month, and it turned out it was dragging on. And now he has this plant that he's paying a mortgage on, and he's paying workers, whatever it is, and they're not producing anything. So he wants to know if he's allowed to package non-kosher meat and sell that under his, he'll have some other label and sell the non-kosher meat in the meantime. The meal was before the psak. Rabbi Schechter said he assumed that it's going to come out, that you're not allowed to do that. But that's only rabbinic. That's only midrabanan. So we might be familiar with that. But that's not from this source. If it was, something else, like a cheeseburger, we'll see, even cheeseburgers are only also midrabanan. So let's get to Yael's question. Yael said, are there differences between things that are derabanan and things that are deraisa? So the answer is yes. This was Rai Bleich in that my second conversation asked me. He said, if you have... are you allowed to sell chicken and cheese, let's say chicken burgers, are you allowed to sell that? Is that asbana or is that mutabahana? So I said, I didn't see that one coming. But I kind of remembered it. So I said, I think it depends whether or not you assume that cooking chicken with cheese is d'oraisa, including this pasuk, or is it not, which is a very old machlokas. We pasken that it's not included, so therefore it would be allowed. But if you assume, like some do, that it's d'oraisa, then you're not allowed to sell it. So that's just set in my mind, that's what I thought. So he said, okay, good. What's the source for that? Who says that? So I said, threw something out there. I said the Pri Chadash, which is one of the Svarim on Shulchan Aruch. I said the Pri Chadash says that. He says the Pri Chadash. I'm like, the Pri Megadim? So he said, yes, yeah, the Pri Megadim. I said, okay, great, that's good enough for me. And then earlier I looked, it is the Pri Megadim, and you know who he's quoting? He's quoting the Pri Chadash. I happen to have guessed right the first time. Either way, so that would be one difference between D'oraisa D'rabbanan, are you allowed to sell it after the fact? And there are others as well. For example, he says over here that if you eat milk and meat, so then the person will get malchus. That's not true if it's D'rabbanan. Malchus is reserved for violating Torah laws, not for violating rabbis' laws. So that's... there are others also. I'll give you a third. I mean, this is a case that happens much more often than those. Let's say you have chicken soup, and you have this big pot of chicken soup, and some milk falls into your chicken soup. I know what's happened. It's okay. So you don't know whether or not how much chicken soup do you need. So the chicken soup will still be mutter, even though you have milk in there. So we'll see it's 60. We'll see. We're going to get to that. Let's say you don't know whether or not it's 60. You don't know. It's hard to know. Like, let's say about a tablespoon fell in, but you don't know. Was it 2 tablespoons? It's hard to know the difference between 2 tablespoons and 1/2 tablespoon when it's just like spilling out of the container. So... the difference between, 60 times, I actually did this because somebody asked, 60 times 2 tablespoons, I believe, is 12 cups, something like that. So you need a lot, but 60 times 1/2 tablespoon is only 3 cups. So you have to know, so there's a very big difference. So what you should say, and it doesn't always come out like this, but is, if it's a case of a d'rabbanan, so whenever there's a case of a question by a d'rabbanan, so it's going to be allowed. Whenever this case is d'oraisa, it's not allowed. So it depends. Is it chicken soup? So then it's chicken. That's going to be d'rabbanan. Or is it flankin? And then it's going to be d'oraisa. So that's going to be another application of that question. It doesn't always play out like that because there are other factors that have to be included. So that's what we've seen over here. The Rambam says that from this pasuk we see there are 3 yisurim. And let's see that case. Okay? Basar shenafel letoch chalav. This question has been coming up for the last 800 years. You have either meat that falls into milk or milk that falls into meat. So if it's cold, let's say you have your container of milk and a piece of meat falls in, so it's not really a problem. You just pull out the meat and you're okay. But the Ram's case is more likely. The nispashal imo falls into a pot that's on the fire. So your chicken soup or you're making... hot cocoa, and something falls into that. So that's hot. This bashal imo shiuro bendosin tam. So the amount that matters is the amount that's going to change the taste. Meaning, if you have hot cocoa, right? So what do you put in hot cocoa? You put in milk, you put in cocoa, and you put in sugar. So we all know what hot cocoa tastes like. Imagine that you also put in a drumstick. Do you think that would change the taste of the hot cocoa? It would, right? So that's called no same time. That means that when I put in an extra ingredient, even though the chicken didn't dissolve in the milk, you pulled it out after a couple minutes, it's going to change the taste. That's called no same time. If you can taste it, so then you're not allowed to eat it. If you can't taste it, if the amount of chicken was so small so you can't taste it, so then you can eat it. So classically what you did was, if you had meat that fell into your hot cocoa and you wanted to know if you're allowed to eat it or not, so you do taste it. But what's the problem with that? You can't taste it because it might actually taste like the chicken, and then you can't eat it anymore. What's that? Can you taste and spit it out? That would be a machlokas rishonim, whether or not it's called plita, whether if tasting something and not swallowing it, is that allowed or not allowed? That's a machlokas between Tosfos and the Rambam, what the definition of tasting is. The word tasting, does it mean like taking a taste, which means you take a small amount but you swallow it, or does it mean like rinsing your mouth like you would if you were like tasting wine and then spitting it out? That's a machlokas. So if you're machmir, you wouldn't be allowed to do that also. So good question. Yeah.
What if it's the spices that were chicken? Spices can really make
spices, great. We're not gonna, I don't have that over here. That's called avida l'taima, which means it's Aramaic for, it's made for tasting. Avida means ovid, it's made. And l'taima means l'tam, for to change the flavor, for flavoring. And it, this is also another question that comes up all the time. Those are not batel, because, let's say, for example, you know, you put pepper. Obviously, you have more than 60 times the amount of pepper in your soup, but you still taste the pepper. Same thing with salt. Obviously, you only the 60th of salt, but you still taste it. So that, if you had salt, that was usur, which is highly uncommon. More likely would be pepper. Let's say you have pepper like you during Shemitah. So you could have a case where the pepper is usur. So then it would not be batel, even if you if it's 60 times, because of course you would taste it after that. But there are cases of you know, in between types of things. So getting back to our hot cocoa thing, right? So you have the hot cocoa, and you we said, how are you going to taste it to find out whether or not it tastes like chicken or not? So you need a tasting guide. Excellent. That's exactly what it says over here. Let's read it. Ketzad, chaticha shabasas shenafel kedeiru rosacha shalchalav. You have a piece of meat that falls into a boiling hot pot of milk because you're making hot cocoa. Toeim hagoy es hakedeira. So you have this non-Jew, some non-Jew, and the non-Jew will taste it, and he'll tell you, does it taste, does the milk taste as if it has meat in it? In which case, you're not allowed to eat it. Im amar sheyesh bo tam basar, if it tastes like it has meat in it, asura, so then you're not allowed to drink the hot cocoa. Vim lav, but if you can't taste the meat, then you can drink the hot cocoa. And you're a lucky person because you can have that hot cocoa.
Simply just give him the whole cocoa with the chicken and all.
See, you speak like an American. You speak like an American. But I remember, I guess I can't remember, but I am sure that those who had hot cocoa when it wasn't so prevalent, they wanted to salvage their hot cocoa. And what's more, they probably only had one pot. They wanted to salvage the pot also. So this is what the Rambam says. He's quoting the Gemara. Actually, this is what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, that you have a non-Jew taste all these foods. And the Ramah, that same Ramah of Krakow, quotes the Minhag of Ashkenaz. You ever heard, ever seen such a thing? Never, right? Never seen such a thing. So the Ramah, the reason is because the Ramah, 500 years ago, already said that the minhag at that time was not to to ask non-Jews to taste our food. Rather, we're going to go with the 60. Why? What's the difference? So there are a couple of suggestions. One suggestion might be, is can you really ask anybody? Can you just go over to your neighbor and ask them, does this taste like meat or does it not taste like meat? Or when we do you need somebody who has a very sophisticated palate? And this is the machlokas between Tosfos and the Rashba, whether or not you have to specifically ask a chef to taste your food.
I've heard of a goyish cup, I never heard of a goyish mouth.
Oh, very common, very common. So can you just ask anybody, or it has to be a
bucky.
A bucky? Exactly. That's actually the language that they're. That's what they're called. You have to ask a bucky, somebody who's a chef. Another possibility is that this minhag developed in a place where the Jews and non-Jews had very poor relationships, and they couldn't trust each other. Or more specifically, in the case of here, the Jews didn't trust the non-Jews to give them honest answers. So it developed in that time that they wouldn't ask non-Jews to taste the food, and therefore, what is it? We'll read the next halach we have to skip. Just to point out, these Rambam, these halachas that we're reading, are not in order. You see, the first one is Tes Aleph, the second one is Tes Ches, Tes Yud Aleph. We're skipping around in those halachas. Okay, so let's see, what do you do if you can't find your your non-Jew to taste it. Im lo nimsa goy she yitom v'nismoch alav. The Rama adds in v'nismoch alav. If you can't find a non-Jew who you can rely on, so maybe he means that it's somebody who you don't trust, or it means it's not a chef, or he doesn't say. He might just mean, he might just be putting it in. Misharim b'shishim. You need 60 times. Bein basar l'toch chalav, bein chalav toch basar. Either 60 times, the milk will have 60 times the volume of the meat, or vice versa. Echa b'shishim mutter. If it's a 60-to-1 ratio, then it's allowed. Pachas mishishim, if it's less than 60-to-1 ratio, so then it's aser.
So if you're a poor European woman and you want to save your pot,
yes,
can you pull out the drumstick and add more milk and cocoa?
Oh, that's a discussion. That is called. I think that's actually a Mishnah. That's called in the Vatzal Nistachatka. The question was, can you just add more milk? So you had, you had just a little bit of milk, it became less fluff. Just add, pour on the milk, so you have 60 times. So that's called Eim Vatzal Nistachatka. You're not allowed to purposely nullify the taste. If it happens, then we'll figure out what to do with it. But to do it on purpose is not allowed.
There goes the pot.
Well, then you kasha the pot. We'll work it out. You can come do a Haggadah before Pesach, right?
They didn't have plastic handles then, so that's okay.
They did not have any plastic handles back then. They only had metal everything, or wood. So that's what we do. We work with shisha. But although the Ram doesn't mention it over here, he says you need 60-to-1 of the milk to the meat. So it's not exactly accurate. He's talking about the most extreme cases. But let's say you have chicken soup, right? And some milk falls into your chicken soup. So you have, you put in half a chicken, two bottoms and the wings. That's what I do. I'll tell you what I really do is I save the wings each week. Am I the only one who does this? Probably not, right? I save the wings each week, and then when I compile it, when I have enough wings, so then I could just put the wings, because nobody eats wings in my house, right? I'm not telling that the only one. Right? We'll share your tricks later. And then you'd say a tablespoon of, or 2 tablespoons of milk falls into your pot of chicken soup. So you're not going to have 60 times 2 tablespoons of milk. The volume of the chicken is not going to be 120 tablespoons. That's tons of chicken. But it's very possible that you'll have 60 times the 120 tablespoons in the whole pot, right? So when the Rambam says you need 60 times, he doesn't mean just the meat versus the milk. He means whatever the smallest amount is, here it's 2 tablespoons of milk, you need 60 times that of everything else. So it can't, even if it's all meat, that would still be allowed. But also, if it you count the milk, you count the water, you count the vegetables, you count, the Gemara says you count the spices, you count the chicken, as much as you can get versus the milk. The Gemara says imagine this. Question whether or not you can count the pot. What about the volume of the pot? Does that also count? So it doesn't really matter so much for us, but you have to remember that traditional pots were cast iron, or I don't know what they had before cast iron, and they were like an inch thick. So the volume of the pot was very significant. The Gemara says, well, can you count the pot to count for this 60 times the milk? And this is a machlokas of the Gemara, and we say, no. We say no. We only count the food. You don't count the other thing.
If it's chicken and not meat, it's a whole different story anyway.
If it's chicken and not meat, so then you would have a question of, you have the same question of, is it 60 or is it not? But there will be room for leniency in a case where it's not. You don't know how much there was. But again, in those cases, there are, what you see about, this might be true all over, but what you see in the halachos of kashrus is that over years, over generations, there are new concepts that are introduced. So like in your case, let's say there's a case, you don't know whether or not you had 60 times the chicken soup. For the milk. So you say, well, I don't know how much milk fell in, and it's only chicken anyway, so it's okay, right? So the Rashba says no. The Rashba says that, you really should have paid more attention when you poured in the milk. Just because you weren't paying attention, therefore everything's okay. He says no. The only time you're allowed to rely on this suffix, because, it's only chicken, And or no, the only time you're allowed to rely on that is if you spilled out the chicken soup already. So you can't taste it. You can't give it to somebody to taste. But if you can still try to figure it out, or you should have paid closer attention, so then you can't rely on the stuff. This is an example of, as the snowball rolls, it gets larger and larger. So you know, you get that, the svarim that added a lot of these minhagim, the one was the Rashba. The Rashba wrote a very important sefer on kashrus that almost nobody learns. It's called Torah Habayis, the Torah of the house. And in there he talks a lot about kashrus, because kashrus is done at home. So we don't, it's not usually studied directly, but it's quoted very often in Shulchan Aruch. And then there was an unbelievable sefer called Shari Dura, which means the gates of Dura. Dura was some town, someplace in Europe. And they kept Minhagim. They kept the book of Minhagim, and kept of Halachos, a book of Halachos. And it grew over generations. And it became this unbelievable work on the Halachos of Kashrus that was maintained by the community of Dura. And it became one of the foundational works of Halachos of Kashrus. I think in the 13th century or something. But it's quoted very often by the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam. So that's the so we've spoken about, what did we talk about so far? We spoke about 60 times. We spoke about milk and meat. We spoke about when are you allowed to sell it and not sell it. And so let's get to
cooking
in the same oven. I actually have that on the sheet.
That's my question.
There we go. Okay. Cooking in the same oven. But before we get to cooking in the same oven, let's talk about cooking in the same pots. Okay? How do we know? We're looking for a source again. Text to practice. How do we know that you're not allowed to cook in the same pots? Why can't you have your milk and your meat in the same pots? It says you're not allowed to cook in the milk. How do you know you can't cook it in your milk pot? So it doesn't say it in our pasuk. It doesn't. But it doesn't say a lot of things in our pasuk. How are we going to... So it actually, this is one of the things that actually says it in a different pasuk. In the middle of nowhere, literally in the middle of nowhere, to the end of Sefer Bamidbar, after the war with Midian, so we have the story of Pinchas and Balak, there's a war with Midian, and the Jews captured, during the war of Midian, they captured a lot of spoils. And part of the spoils was, or were, pots. So what do they do with all these pots that they got from Midian? So, what's that?
They tabled them.
They had to table them. And they also had to kasha them. How do you know? Because it says in the pasuk over here, and this pasuk is very important because it tells us, it's a way to remember how you kasha all your different things before Pesach. The pasuk is the last source. The pasuk at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, kol davar sheyavol ve'ish, any utensil that's used directly in fire. I mean, this doesn't mean a pot that goes on the fire, because you'll see that's the second part of the pasuk. This is something that's cooked directly in fire. An example would be a baking sheet, or the more classical example, when they didn't really use baking sheets, were roasting spits. You don't really use those so much anymore. Like shawarma, right, a rotisserie stick. So that, the way you have the, you know, those are upright. But you know, you have the lamb on the spit and you roast it over an open fire. So that's kol davar sheyavol ve'ish. That's used directly in fire. How do you kosher that? Now obviously the lamb that they used in Midian, that Midian was not kosher, right? They didn't shecht it. So they had to kosher the spit. Taviru ve'ish. So that has to be passed through fire. V'toher. And then it becomes pure. So the word pure in the Torah is pure in contemporary language means one thing. Pure in the Torah just means mutter, just means allowed. So after you pass it through the fire, it becomes mutter. Ach b'mei nida yischata, it has to be brought to the mikvah. This is what you were talking about. You have to tovel it. And then, this is the next part, v'chol shelo yavo ve'ish, if you don't use it in fire, tavir b'mayim, you pass it through water. This is what we call hagala. So if you use it in fire, if it's a baking sheet, so you kasher it using fire. That means you stick it in your oven and put on self-clean. If it's not used in fire, it's used the other way, with water, meaning it's a pot, so then you have to kasher it using hagala. You have to dip it, right? You boil your gigantic pot and you dip it in, And that removes these are two completely different methods. The first one burns out any taste. For example, this is a question that was asked. You can buy a cast iron pan made, I think, for making pizza. Have you seen these things? Okay. Let's skip this. Cast iron pans can come flavored. Ever heard of that? No? They come flavored. Now, the problem is that they flavor the pan. You buy it flavored, and when you cook it, it has that flavor. The problem is that those flavorings are not necessarily kosher. In fact, often they're probably not kosher. So let's say you have this flavored pan that you want to use, but it's not kosher. So what do? So you have to kosher it. Now the problem is that the only way to kosher a cast iron pan is through self-cleaning it. And if you self-clean it, it destroys the flavoring of the pan. If you put it on your fire and you fry eggs in it or you make pizza in it, whatever it is, so then it retains the taste. Once you self-clean it, the tastes are destroyed in the pan. So if you want one of these pans, they don't come kosher. If you want to buy it and then kosher it, it defeats the purpose, because once you kosher it, it destroys the taste. So what you see from there, which is just what the Torah is getting at, is that koshering with libun, koshering through fire, through self-cleaning, destroyed the utensil imparts a taste. You cook one thing, then you cook something else in it, the taste is absorbed in the utensil, and then it's then niflat, it's then reabsorbed by the next food. But if you kosher it with fire, so the taste is burned out. You just get stuck with the pizza dish. The way it works with water is different. It doesn't destroy the taste, but rather the taste gets mixed in with the water and it becomes negligible with all this gigantic. You have a gigantic pot of water. There's a little bit of residue on the pot that's absorbed in the pot that gets taken out of the pot, and then it's mutter. So this pasuk again is in the middle of nowhere. It's not talking about milk and meat. It's not even talking about lachs of kashrus. It's talking about what they did with the pots that they got from Midian after the war. But this is one of those places where you have the intersection of other areas of halacha with bas b'chos. That's why you can't have milchik pots and meat. You can't have just one set of pots for both, because this pasuk, I think it's in Parshas Maaseh, you have to have separate pots. What about separate ovens? So let's go back one halacha.
Why isn't a dishwasher good enough for Haggadah?
Great question. So why isn't a dishwasher good enough? So a dishwasher is usually not good enough for Haggala for a few reasons. The way Haggala is done is you take a gigantic pot and you dip something else in. So there are a couple of things about that big pot that you need. One is it needs to be with roasting, which means boiling. So the water has to be, I think, like 190 degrees or something like that when it boils. If it's not boiling, so then it's not hot enough to remove the taste from the first utensil. And the second thing you need, which is related to the first, it has to be a kli rishon. It has to be on the fire. You have your gigantic pot, you leave it on the fire, you let it boil, and then while it's on the fire, you put in the other thing. A dishwasher is missing both of those conditions. The water does not get roasted. It's not 190 degrees. It's whatever it is, 100. It gets hot, but it's not hot enough to kasher, and it's also not a kli rishon, because that thing on the bottom that spins. So I heard, I didn't see this, I heard that there's a video on YouTube. Somebody took a video camera, they put it in their dishwasher, and I assume they put a light in there also, or else you wouldn't be able to see anything. And you see what the dishwasher looks like when it's on. And I was told that what you see over there is that when that thing spins, you don't have I would imagine that it's like a stream of water coming out of the bottom. It's not. It's droplets that come out, because it spins so fast. It's in Hebrew it's called nifsak hakiluach. That stream is broken and it comes out as droplets. So if it was came out as a straight stream, we could talk about maybe it's like a kli rishon, like a faucet. Maybe it's like a kli rishon, like it's still on, it has the heating element there. but since it's not, it comes out as droplets, it would not be a clean dishwasher. So that's why you can't use a dishwasher to kosher things that really need koshering, but you can sometimes use your dishwasher to kosher your dishwasher. Because for the same reason, what we see in this pasuk is what's called kibolo kach polto. What I heard from Ray Rosenblatt, what he said, you got us into the mess, you got to get us out of it. So whatever the level of, whatever the severity of the cooking process was at the beginning, that's how high you have to raise it to get the taste out. So if it had the more intense heat of the flame, so then you have to pass it to the flame. And the less intense heat of the water, of boiling water, so that's good enough. So let's say you have a non-kosher dishwasher, you put all your milk and dishes into your flame, whatever it is. So your dishwasher only got up to 140 degrees anyway the first time. So the second time is going to get up to the same temperature, basically. So maybe in that case you'd be allowed to you can kosher your dishwasher with your dishwasher. But if you have, you took your fleishig spoon and you mixed a boiling pot of chalent with it, that spoon got up to, 180 degrees, 170 degrees, putting it in the dishwasher is not going to cut it. Okay, so that's dishwashers, koshering, and the like. So we have the question, what about ovens? Ovens. Milchig oven, fleishig oven, same time, different time, covered, uncovered. What do you say? So there are a few issues that come up with ovens. And they're all applications of what we've already seen. So what are the issues that come up with them? What could possibly be wrong if I made a lasagna before and now I want to make London broil? What could be wrong with that? What's the issue? I'm not mixing the milk and meat now. Right?
Residual,
right. So what about is residual?
Something leaked out of the lasagna into the oven.
Great. So let's say on the bottom of the oven, very common, you have a spill of cheese, of milk, of who knows what. What else could be down there? Butter. We don't cook with butter. We don't cook with margarine either. I know. What are you going to do? She takes very good care of me, though. So you have some spill on the bottom, and now afterwards you put in your chicken. Okay, but they're not touching. So let's see what the Rambam says, and we'll get to a couple. We'll see that it raises some of the issues. So this is Perek Tes Vav Pasuk Halacha Chaf Tes. You'll see this is not in the same Perek as the other ones, because the other ones were in Perek Tes. Those were only exclusively talking about Bas B'chol. You'll see what we're talking about over here is something completely different. Ein Solim Basu Shchutim Basu Nevela. Let's say you have an oven, and I want to make my kosher hamburgers, and my neighbor is making his non-kosher hamburgers in the same oven at the same time. Oh, behemoth mea betanur echas. You're not allowed to roast kosher meat and non-kosher meat in the same oven at the same time. It's just, but they're not touching, right? Bafal pish enogin zebazeh. Even if they don't touch each other, you're still not allowed to cook them together. V'im tsalon harezen mutter. However, interestingly, if you do roast them together in the oven at the same time, so then they're going to be, you're allowed to eat them. V'afil haisa ha'asur shmeina harbe v'amutaris raza. Even if the non-kosher hamburgers were so fatty that they're like, there are drippings on the bottom and you smell them down the hall. Even so, it's still going to be mutter. Shareach eno oser, because even though you can smell it, even though you feel like you can even it's almost, you can almost taste it. Vein oser l'atzmo shel iser. Only the meat itself is oser, so unless it, they touched, which they didn't in this case, so even though you can smell it, and when you take one out, you can still smell the other one. So I guess if they're both meat, you won't be able to tell the difference. But if you would make bread while you're cooking London broil, the bread would smell like meat. True or not? Am I wrong? I might be dead wrong. That's okay. But
I don't think so.
You get, you don't think, it, you
think, I think you're right.
You think it would smell like that. So that's, we have a term for that. It's called recha. It means it smells the same. So you would have thought that, well, recha milsa, which means that if it smells like meat, so just like the meat can't be eaten, the bread can't be eaten. No, the Rambam says that's true, l'chatchila. You're not allowed to do it together to begin with, but if you did, it doesn't become asr. So one issue that you're going to come up against is recha. That if you made your lasagna, so then your oven is going to smell like lasagna. And then you put in your meat right afterwards, so you're inserting your meat into an oven that smells like lasagna. That's going to be this issue that the Rambam raises over here. Even though the Rambam is talking about it at the same time, but if they still smell the same, if you still smell it, that's called recha, and you're not allowed to do that lechatchila. So, yet, so that's the first issue. That just means that you can't do it right afterwards. But let's say you wanted to wait an hour. So then you'll come up possibly against the second issue. And I didn't put this on the sheets, but that's called Zaya. This is a more serious issue. But it's more serious, but it applies in fewer cases. And Zaya is steam. So if you have steam of chicken soup, what do you think it tastes like? It probably tastes like chicken soup, right? Because it's just vaporized chicken soup. Mm-hmm. So if you have your, let's imagine you're cooking your chicken soup. Here, I got it. Gefilte fish. So here's my trick for gefilte fish. Most people make gefilte fish on the stove, right? You boil your gefilte fish on the stove, right?
Make it in the oven.
You make it in the oven? So that's my trick. You also make it in the oven? Why? Because it's so much easier. It's so much easier. You don't have to. I make it in an aluminum pan. You don't even have to clean it. It's the best. You know my other trick? I don't put in any spices. I just pour in sugar, and I don't put in carrots.
Oh, I don't even put in sugar.
What?
Carrots. I just put just carrots.
Yeah, but then you have to end up with the carrots. I just put in sugar, and then you pour out all the water right afterwards. And, okay, so if you have your pan of gefilte fish, let's imagine it wasn't gefilte fish. Let's imagine it was pot roast. So you have your roast with a lot of water in it, and it's boiling, it's been cooking in the oven for 2 hours. So it's very hot, so the water is evaporating, it's creating the steam. The oven is now full of steam from your pot roast. And now you put in your lasagna, so then you have a more serious issue. Doesn't just smell like pot roast, but there's the vapor, the steam, that's called Zeya. Zeya means sweat, but here we'll just call it steam. So the steam, if you have steam in the oven at the same time, so now your oven is really, it's really flashing if you would put something else in at the same time. So if you would cook your lasagna and your pot roast in the oven at the same time, you wouldn't be allowed to eat them afterwards. That's by Zaya. So there are three, and then the third issue is that you put them together, they might splatter onto each other. So you have three possible issues. The first one we saw in this Rambam is called Recha. That's not as severe, that's only l'chatchila. So we'll leave that aside for now. But two real issues, one is Zaya and one is splattering. So to put in those two things at the same time, not be allowed. But that's not really what we're talking about, right? You weren't asking about putting them in at the same time. You're probably more interested in putting them one after the other.
What if you covered them and you don't have them?
Ah, and what if you cover them? Great. Right, great. So what are our issues? Again, there's the smell, there's the steam, and there's the splattering. If they're covered, you don't have any of those issues because the steam can't escape, even though there's a little bit of steam that escapes, obviously. But you don't fill it with steam. And you don't have any splattering issues. So there are, what you get over here, these, what I presented were the basic halachos. What you're going to find are multiple minhagim, how people treat ovens. Milk and meat. I'll just run through them and probably everybody's going to fall somewhere there. Either people use it exclusively for milk or meat, or they use it for both, but they kosher it in between. And they'll either run on a self-cleaner or to leave it on a high heat for an hour or two. Or you'll use it for both, but you'll wait a day in between. Or you'll use it for both. You won't wait a day in between, but you'll wait an hour in between. Or as Ray Willig says, enough time so that it cools down.
Without koshering it,
yeah.
Then you usually reheat the oven anyway to get the oven on. You heat it before you put anything in it. You preheat it.
Right, but you don't have to preheat it if it's already hot. I mean, if you just made your pie crust at 350.
Off, but you let it cool off completely, and after it cools off completely,
that's going to take an hour.
Hours of
right.
Pie. And then if you preheat it,
right. So let's.
Then it's, you're burning it out. Really.
Right. So let's explain these multiple minhagims. So the most chamer one is basically the same as the second one. Either you only use it for meat of milk, or you use it for both the kasher in between. So that's just following these halachas. We treat it as if it's really fleishig. Let's say I made my pot roast, so we assume that steam made the whole oven fleishig. So now the whole oven has the steam absorbed in it. So we have to apply our pasuk. We have to kasher it. So those are the most machmir shitos, the most machmir hagim, the most strict ones. The next one, which would be using it for a day, or let's go to skip to the other side. Using it, allowing it to go back and forth, but waiting in between, so that comes, that's a compilation of a couple of factors. The first is that we assume that the steam is not an issue. Why is steam not an issue? So for multiple reasons. One is that all ovens have vents. And it says in Shulchan Aruch that if your oven has a vent, so then the steam is just going to escape through that vent, and it's not going to be absorbed into the walls of the oven. So we don't have to worry about Zaya. And what about, you don't have to worry about the steam, but what about the smell? So if you wait an hour or 2 hours, so that smell dissipates anyway. So there are some people, I think it's a pretty common minhag in this community, which is to wait some time in between, unless the thing that you just made, if you made pot roast in your oven, so then it had a lot of steam, so then maybe you should kosher your oven. But if you were any of you just making chicken and blunder broil and what else?
But there's a minute where some people wait 3 hours to eat dairy after meat and some 6 hours.
Right.
So you.
But we're not eating the oven.
No, but the point is when you have to wait a certain amount of time in the oven also.
You do have to wait, but they're for different reasons. Maybe we'll talk about that next week, why we wait between milk and meat. But what we're talking about over here is the mixing of the different foods. When you wait, the concern is, I mean, the concern really is that they're going to mix, but in a different way. But when you wait for eating, you know, you have your hamburger, and then you wait 6 hours, the concern is not that you mix the ice cream with the meat. The concern is that you have to separate them.
Yeah, but in the oven, when you make the meat, and then if you want to make dairy, why don't you have to wait? I mean, some people wait 3 hours, some 6 hours.
Because the 3 hours, let's say, is the point of waiting after meat, 3 hours, is so that you don't have any meat stuck in your teeth anymore. But that's not going to be a problem by an oven. That's what the Rambam says. So that's a difference. So I think let's stop it over here. I think we covered a lot. So, and to leave room for questions, because we need questions. Yes.
So
you want to hear your name? Is that okay?
Okay. So presumably the same whatever your minhag is for meat, dairy, to meat, you apply it to parv. And by parv I mean just make your pot roast, and then you're going to make your challahs, and you're going to serve your challah with cream cheese to your kids at a later time, right? So you want your challahs to be truly parv.
Okay.
So would you apply the same principle, or would you be more lenient?
So that's a good question. It's not necessarily intuitive, because you are going to serve it with cream cheese, but we do apply leniency in those cases. Let's say you want to make your challah in your oven. So let's say like this. I only use my oven for fleishig, let's say. But I'll still make challah in my oven, even though I'm going to serve it with dairy, because then you're throwing in so many other factors that would allow it to be
house. The oven is basically fleishig, but I do make challahs in the oven. I mean, I make desserts, but whatever. Desserts usually go with fleishig meat. But I make challahs that are then served with cream cheese throughout the week.
Right.
So am I completely...
That's fine. No, that's fine. But you will still want to wait between those at least a couple hours to get
it. Do the challah first.
Well, you're still waiting because you have used your oven in the past for meat.
Oh, well, if you do the challah first, on Thursday night, and then the next
but
morning.
Yeah, on Wednesday, everybody has hamburgers Wednesday. On Wednesday. So it's okay, just wait a little bit. Yeah. Yes, the reason that there's a difference is because the steam is really only produced by cooking.
So because it would be dry afterwards, we assume that there's no steam. If you made a wet batter into a fluffy cake.
So wet batter, even though it's wet, doesn't produce steam. I mean, when we say wet, we mean like a pot roast, something that has a lot of liquid in it. And then it's going to... different how they treat it differently.
What about carb at the same time as milk that you want to start finishing? So if you cover...
If it's covered, for sure, it's fine.
And carb after milk is the same thing as finishing after milk.
If you're going to serve it at a fleshing meal, let's say you're, you know, you're making brownies... I mean, even brownies are serving after the fleshing meal. Let's say you're making, you know, crackers that you're going to serve with meat, so then you should wait. If it's going to be afterwards, then it's really not such a big deal anyway.
But if there's no zea because it's brownies and it's not wet.
But what'd you make before?
Okay, so I made chicken in my oven.
Chicken with sauce?
Sure.
Let's say a lot of sauce.
Tons of sauce.
So then
barbecue.
You're right. So there's no zea from the brownies, but the zea is still there from the.
It was present from the chicken.
It was present. Yeah. There's room again. There's going to be a lot of room over there to be made.
Well, the brownies are hot.
That's the middle of my answer.
Unbelievable. But if you warm up your chicken and your challah like Erev Shabbos,
uh-huh.
going into Shabbos, you're warming up your meat covered, but your challah is uncovered.
Yeah.
So that's still
if fine. Your meat is covered, so what you're doing with that is you're enclosing all the steam that would possibly come out, and the smell is being kept inside. So some people actually double cover it for other reasons. Well, we're not going to get to right now. But once it's enclosed, it's not going to transfer to the challah. So that would be great. We encourage that. Now, obviously, there are those who say that you shouldn't do that either. But if you, it's okay to be making in that case. You have a very specific question.
If you heat it up at like 200 instead of like normal heating temperatures,
would
that be okay?
200.
Like low. You're not cooking it.
If it doesn't get hot, it doesn't get hot. But the critical temperature that we talk about is Yad Soledes, which means that it's hot, too hot to touch, about 160 degrees or something. But if you put your oven on 200, your food is not going to hit 160.
Yeah.
Your food's going to be cold when you take it out of the oven. So,
unless it's cooked out there, when it's cooked already.
If you put it on a low heat for a long time.
You put it in a quiche, you put it in a milk quiche into the oven, it doesn't get hot for a long time.
Right. But once it gets yad soledes, so then you should treat it as everything else. Once your quiche hits 160. If you're heating it up, you want it to get yad soledes. Nobody. Real, I do it because I eat everything cold anyway. But if you, I'm not willing to wait till it heats up. But if you want it to heat up, you means you want it to get over yad soledes. Nobody heats things up under yad soledes. Other questions?
I guess when you cover everything, you have to be careful maybe to put it to the top of the oven when you check on it during cooking so that you don't have any chance of zea either.
If yes.
You're putting it on an oven door or something like that.
Right, right.
But you have to.
Right, exactly. You don't want to open it up. But once, yes, you try to, if you're going to open it up, take it out of the oven first and then open it. So that whatever steam escapes outside the oven, then stick it back in.
Is zea the reason why some people have separate spices and things like that? You put it on top of
Yes, that's exactly the reason. Because if you're pouring pepper into your soup, so if your soup is hot, there's that steam coming out, and that steam is going to settle on your spices. Yeah, absolutely. Another practice, and I think this is what chefs do anyway, you don't shake your spices directly into the soup anyway because who knows what's going to happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We all, you know, the last person didn't put the cover back on top of the paprika. It's always the paprika.
Pepper.
Oh, the pepper?
It's really
well, it's usually the pepper because the paprika doesn't come out. It doesn't
come
out. Oh, that's also true. Yes. Yes. So that's another added, I just poured in, but there's another added benefit of pouring it into your hand. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ashkar. Tomorrow, next week, 8:15, as always. Thank you so much for coming to our Women's Bishop Bash.
If you have recipes written up also.
Yes, yes. If you have suggestions of topics to discuss, please let me know.
So much fun.
Thank you for coming.